Hey, great to have you here this morning. Nice to be part of this series on Created to Thrive. And if you remember, we said that every second message we were going to have someone that had expertise in the particular area that we were talking about. And last week we started into the body, and we said, "Is your body a temple? Is it a temporary shell, or is it an amusement park?" So we talked a little bit about that, and today I'm going to just introduce our special guest, Dr. Jill Matsuo. So, Dr. Jill, would you come on up and be a part of our service this morning? As we can clap. This is such an important topic, and hey, nice to have you here. Are you ready for this? Yeah. Okay, can everybody hear Dr. Jill?
Good morning. All right. I think it's on.
Yeah, it's on. Yeah. Hey, we're good. So you are a doctor with family practice, and you've got this extensive experience of dealing with people's bodies.
You have some experience.
So, you know, we talked last week about this whole business of honoring our bodies with God, and I thought it'd be really cool to have you come in because this is your wheelhouse. This is what you deal with on a regular basis. And, you know, and in Canada, we're very fortunate to have a healthcare system. We're very fortunate to, you know, be in the country that we live in with a lot of the benefits that we have. So as a doctor, you know, if you were to tell people, what do you feel is the biggest looming health crisis? What would you say it is?
So I have sort of three things that I think are looming health crises. So I'm a family doctor, so, you know, specialists know everything about one thing, and family doctors know a little bit about everything. So I'm certainly not an expert. And looking out here, you know, you guys are fine physical specimens, so I'm sure that this will be a very easy talk for me, so thank you.
Looking out there, but not, yeah.
Well, and right here. I'm just going to move a bit, because I feel like it. So the first thing is antibiotic resistance. So not what we talked about last week at all, but actually something I think is really important and really kind of scary. So antibiotics, of course, are the medications that we use to fight infections. So we have over time, and physicians have in large part been the problem in this. We've prescribed too many antibiotics, and we've prescribed them for the wrong things. And so when bacteria are exposed to antibiotics for long periods of time, they get smart, and they start to change themselves. And so the antibiotics no longer work against them, and that's what we're starting to see. So one thing is, what is an antibiotic? So think about it as an antibacterial. So it fights against bacteria. And bacteria are the things that cause us things like strep throat, some ear infections, things like pneumonia or bladder infections. What they don't work against are viruses. So viruses are the things that can also actually cause us ear infections. They cause us the common cold. They can cause throat infections as well. So if I give you an antibiotic and you actually just have a virus, it's not going to help you get better, so you're still going to stay sick. It may give you a yeast infection, or it may give you diarrhea, or it may give you something called Clostridium difficile, which is this toxin that we're seeing because the antibiotics have cleared away the bad and the good bacteria in our guts, and it causes resistance. So for us, this is really, really scary. There's these things called superbugs that you might have heard of. So they have really scary names: methicillin-resistant Staph aureus and vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus and extended spectrum beta-lactamase things, so these really scary names. So for some of these things, they've become resistant, and sometimes we can overcome the resistance by giving higher doses of antibiotics. So parents, if you've taken your kids to the emergency department or to the doctor with an ear infection, you may say, wow, they're like having a lot more amoxicillin than they did last year when they had their ear infection. And that's because we've actually had to double the doses of amoxicillin to overcome the resistance. Now, these ESBL bugs, extended spectrum beta-lactamase bacteria, they're something that we're monitoring, But so far, it hasn't caused clinical infection, so it's not actually making people sick yet. The really scary thing is that if it starts to make people sick, they have clinical infection, we have no antibiotics that will fix this. So we don't have anything to do. So for physicians, that's a really, really scary thing. So you're thinking, why am I telling you this? I'm the problem because I've been giving these antibiotics out too much. So the reason I'm telling you is because I think you need to know. So education is really important. So if you are fairly well and you develop a cold and you don't have a fever and you're not having shortness of breath, maybe you don't have to run to your doctor. Maybe you don't have to run to the emergency department and wait there for 5 hours to get seen. Or if you go to the emergency department and you've waited that 5 hours and I tell you, well, you've got a really sore throat and you feel really bad, but I don't have anything that's going to make you better, then you're going to understand why that is. And parents who have kids, there's a good study out to say if your child is two or older, if they're relatively well and they have an ear infection, we may say treat the pain because that's what keeps you and that's what keeps the kid up in the middle of the night and makes them miserable. But we may say wait for 2 or 3 days before we give you an antibiotic because it might be viral and it might be better during that time. So it's not that we don't care and it's not that we don't want your child to feel better, but these are the things that are going to help us. And what we've seen is that by doing this, the resistance levels are actually going down. So we're actually going to hopefully start to be able to use antibiotics that aren't working for us now in the future. So you need to keep us on track as well. And if we're saying, hey, I'm going to give you this antibiotic for your sore throat and we don't think it's strep, though, you should be asking your doctor about that, especially at walk-in clinics or at emergency departments. So that's the first kind of looming health crisis. The second thing, and we can jump ahead, I think, 2 slides, is salt. So the World Health Organization says that we should reduce death by 2.5 million people per year if the global salt consumption were reduced to the recommended levels.
2.5 million?
Yeah, that's huge.
Wow.
So, you know, as Christians, we're called to be the salt of the earth. We're just not called to eat it.
A biblical joke. That's that's really good.
So, next slide, please. So how much is okay? So they say if you don't have high blood pressure, then 2,000 milligrams per day is okay. That sounds like a really huge number, 2,000 milligrams. But in 1 teaspoon of salt, there's 2,300 milligrams of sodium. So that's like over your daily consumption in a teaspoon of salt. Now, if you have high blood pressure, you should keep that salt intake under 1,500 milligrams. So for people who have computers and smartphones and stuff like that, there's a website and an app called sodium101.ca that you can actually put in. They have a little salt shaker you could put in if you use the salt shaker. You can put in for a number of the most common foods that you buy in restaurants you go to. You can look it up, and it'll tell you, if I eat that Big Mac, how much salt is going to be in that? And I'll tell you, it's probably enough for like 3 days or maybe 5 days, the amount of salt in that.
What about stuff like Himalayan salt and things like that?
Yeah, so you know what? Salt is kind of salt, so I don't think there's, you know, they say that sea salt is better for you.
Sorry, guys, I tried.
I don't think sea salt is any better for you. So how do you know how much salt you're taking in? So you can do a salt tally, because most of my patients, when we start to talk about salt, and I talk about this a lot with them, they say, but I don't use the salt shaker, and we don't cook with salt, so we're okay. So the thing is that 90% of the salt you take in a day actually comes from salt that's already in things. So there's some things that are really obvious, like, you know, canned soup is what everybody says is the first thing when you ask them about salt. And it's true. In one serving, there's 890 milligrams of sodium. So that's more than half of your daily intake. But if you think of something that we might think of healthy, like whole wheat bread, so if you have 2 slices of bread, you're making a sandwich, and you haven't put anything in between yet, you're already up to 430 milligrams of sodium. So breads and cereals actually have a lot of salt in them. So do a salt tally, take a day, look at the nutritional label, so on the back of the products you're using, write down the number of milligrams of sodium. So if you're having 2 servings, you double it, and add it up. And at the end of the day, if that number's over 1,500 or 2,000 milligrams, go back and look at the few things that are really high in salt and go to the grocery store, because if you do a little brand comparison, you'll actually find that you can find things that they haven't added salt to. You can find ketchup that doesn't have salt added, and it actually tastes like tomatoes, not just sugar and salt. So I've had people with high blood pressure who we have on a number of medications. They've done a salt tally, they've gone home, they've made changes, and they've actually dropped that top number, which is called the systolic blood pressure, which should be under 140. They've dropped that like about 20 points, and that's more than than I've been able to get it to drop with any kind of medication. So it's really incredible. If you lower the salt content, what you can do.
My blood pressure is rising, actually, right now. Talking. That's a big deal.
It is.
Absolutely a big deal.
Yeah. Okay. So the third thing, and I think we can, is the World Health Organization again. So they named the top three most severe non-communicable, so things that we don't pass along to each other, diseases causing problems in today's Western world, so our world. And the three were, no surprise, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. So this is for adults. So all three of these things are related. So obesity is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and for diabetes. And diabetes is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. In fact, if you're a diabetic, you have the same risk of a heart attack as somebody who's already had a heart attack. So really, really strong risk factor. The good news is that all three of these things, we can do things to try and prevent or try and decrease our risk for those. So we're going to go into those things like a lot, in a lot of detail in a couple of minutes. So that's for adults. But what about for kids? So the number one cause of death for kids up to the age of 25 is accidents, accidents, accidents for sure. And then you start getting into some mental health things like suicide and homicide, and then cancers kind of start to creep in there. So as parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and friends, make sure your kids are wearing helmets. It's the law for biking, so that's a no-brainer, but I tell them, hey, wear your helmet if you're skateboarding, and wear your helmet if you're on your scooter, and wear your helmet if you're on anything really that has wheels. Now, you often see families out biking, which is great, but the kids will be wearing helmets and the parents aren't wearing helmets because it's no longer the law. So be a good example for your kids so they don't think, hey, when I turn 16, I just don't have to wear my helmet anymore because it's not cool. I do some bike riding and I have a very large head, and you'll never ever see a hat on this head, but I will always wear my helmet because it just makes sense. So seatbelts are another thing, which is a bit of, I think, a no-brainer for people these days, but they've actually increased the age that kids need to stay in booster seats as well, because we know that they save lives. But the biggest thing about seatbelts is put them on your kids properly. So the seatbelt, the lap belt part, needs to be down where the hip bones are, because if they stop quickly, the hip bones can take that impact of the force. If you put it up by their bellies, that force is going to go straight through, and it's going to cut through their intestines and their kidneys and their liver and their spine. And I've seen that in an accident with kids. So make sure you put it on them properly. Swimming lessons, I think all kids should have swimming lessons. Even if you have a pool, I think it's just a safety thing. If they end up in the water, they need to be able to, you know, swim enough that they can keep themselves safe. And then if your kids are walking to school or they're biking to school, just make sure that you teach them the rules of the road so that they can do what they can to kind of protect themselves. So that's the thing with kids.
I've got a 14-month-old grandson who is already starting to leap off the top stair.
Right, with no fear.
With no fear.
Maybe like we can just start putting him in a helmet right now.
Yeah, I think a body kind of protectant type of, yeah, absolutely. But that, I was really surprised to see that accidents were that prominent.
Far and away, yeah, for sure.
Okay, great. Are we on to the next question?
We're on to the next question.
Yeah. Okay. As a doctor, what are the most distressing habits that you see as it relates to the way people treat their bodies?
Right. So I think, you know, everybody, I think, wants to be healthy. And I think in general, people really know sort of what you need to do to be healthy. But what I think, where I think troubles come in, is that I think we underestimate the importance of taking care of our bodies. And I think that people try things and they get discouraged. And so that leads to lack of action. They just give up. So hopefully today we'll talk about some things that kind of are barriers for us in terms of looking after our physical health, and then hopefully I can give you some tips or tricks that might help you to get over those barriers so you get past that discouragement and you get motivated again to do something to look after your physical health and to improve that. So the first thing we're going to talk about, of course, is food. So we love food. I love food. I'm a total foodie. Watch the Food Network all the time. But we're going to talk about what we eat and how we eat and then when we eat. So first of all, what we eat. So how do we even know what we eat? They've done all kinds of dietary studies over time, and what they found out recently is they're really not they're not effective, because people underreport what they eat and we sort of overreport how well we eat. So we're not good at telling what we eat. So what I would say is, you know, go home this afternoon and get your receipts out from this last week and get your grocery bill out and look what's on your grocery bill. If it's all full of fruits and vegetables and fish and good things like that, excellent. You're eating good things. If it's all these kind of box things and processed things and things that you just have to heat and eat, maybe there's some room for improvement. So that'll tell you, what are you eating, right? Do a diet diary for a day or two. So if you actually just carry around a little piece of paper in your pocket or get a little notepad on your smartphone and you write down every single thing that you put in your mouth, you might be surprised because there's all those little things. You know, you walk by the coffee table and you just throw a Timbit in your mouth and there's like 90 calories. And you put that little candy in your mouth because your mouth is dry and there's like another 60 calories. And at the end of the day, you might be surprised. So I think we need to know sort of what we're eating. And then the third thing is to kind of learn to look at labels. So never look at the front of a package because the front is where the marketing is. So the front says, you know, no sugar added, but that's in a big container of juice that already has all the natural sugar in. So they haven't added any, but there's tons of sugar in there. And everything says no cholesterol these days. But if you look at the back of the label, you can see maybe there's still some trans fats in there. Maybe there are the bad fats in there for us. So ignore the front of the package. Look at the back of the package to get an idea. So, of course, fresh is best. So if you know, hey, this is a carrot that I've pulled out of the garden, there's nothing in there but the carrot. So if you use fresh things and you cook things, you're going to know exactly what goes into it. There's not going to be any weird preservatives. You'll know that there's no salt in it unless you're pulling out the salt shaker. So definitely fresh is best. Now, fresh is costly, and not everybody has lots of money. So to go to the grocery store and buy fresh fruits and vegetables, it costs more money. But a couple of things that you can do. If you have a green thumb, grow your own vegetables. You can buy a packet of seeds for like $1.29. I don't have a particularly green thumb, so I tried to grow all kinds of vegetables this summer, and I harvested all my carrots about two weeks ago, and that gave me enough for like one serving of carrots for myself. So hopefully you're better gardeners than I am, but you can grow vegetables. There are farmers markets around all over the place now, and talk to people, but you can get really local stuff, which is not traveled, so it tastes better, and you can get it for a really good price. And then frozen fruits and vegetables, we've always kind of thought of bad things, but they're not bad things. They're fruits and vegetables that have been picked at the peak of their ripeness, and they're flash frozen right away. So they're definitely cheaper than buying fresh. You can keep them in the freezer for quite a long time. So that's a couple of ways that you can get fresh things without having a big cost. If you plan ahead, so I'm not great, honestly, at planning ahead, but I always have lettuce, so I eat a lot of salad in my life because I don't have kids that I have to feed with other things. But if you plan ahead and you make a menu when you do have time in the week, and then you take that menu with you when you go grocery shopping and only buy the things that are on that menu, you're going to do better with your grocery shopping. And of course, the thing like don't go grocery shopping when you're hungry because they put all the, you know, things, the snack things and the pops and the things that you're feeling like you'll want.
But when you get to Costco, you end up getting hungry because they've got all the booths out there and stuff like that.
Costco is probably not a good thing for our health in general. Bigger is better. And you go to Costco when you like eat a whole meal with the samples.
Yeah, we got to bleep that part out. You know.
Oh, wait, sorry. And then I'm too busy. And people really are busy, right? So we're volunteering and you're at the church for meetings and you're taking your kids to their 5,000 lessons that happen. So time is trouble. But remember, I said I'm a foodie and I watch the Food Network a lot. And there's a chef by the name of Jamie Oliver. So he's this British chef, and he did it, so people know him, yeah. So he did a show once where he had somebody come up and had them made a box of, like, processed macaroni and cheese, and he actually made a meal where he actually cooked things, and he finished before the person who made the box of macaroni and cheese.
Really?
And, of course, he made this really tasty meal. But it takes thinking ahead. So we talked about our thought lives a number of weeks ago, and that's all kind of, all of these things go together. If you think about things and if you're thoughtful about things, then your physical health is going to be better.
This is all on the ground, practical stuff about how we can honor God with our bodies.
Right.
But, you know, we live in this rush around world, drive through, grab it fast, and yet we're hurting ourselves.
Yeah.
I don't mean to interject, but, yeah, I do mean to interject, but I just read last night a report out of the U.S. that said that immigrants coming into the U.S. are typically healthier than the people who have been living there all their lives.
Yeah,
because of the difference in the way they eat.
And I don't know the study. There's a study that looks at the number of places in the world where people are sort of the happiest and the healthiest, and it's not us. But it's places where, yeah, they don't have like a lot of processed things and they don't have a lot of fast food things and areas where they kind of grow their own foods. And I'm going to talk a little bit about a movie that's coming out and a study that talks a bit about that
okay.
As well.
Okay.
So the next thing about what we eat are food traps. So things that we think we're doing that are really healthy, but might not actually be as healthy as we think. So the first thing are liquid calories. So this is things like juice and alcohol and pops and stuff like that. Oh, my slide. I did all this animation, so I don't talk. I don't speak with people. I just speak with patients. So I haven't done PowerPoint for 20 years. So I was YouTubing PowerPoint. So this is supposed to come up all, separate. But in one glass of orange juice, which we think, hey, this is a healthy thing. I'm going to have orange juice with my breakfast. It's actually the equivalent sugar of 8 oranges. So nobody would sit down and eat 8 oranges, and all you get in the orange juice is the concentrated sugar. You don't get the fiber that you get with oranges as well. So the Canadian Pediatric Society actually says that kids should get no juice in their diet, none at all. They should have milk and they should have water because they should eat fruit and get their sugars and fiber from fruits instead of juices. So the other thing are things like alcohol and pops, which we do a lot of the times. And if you drink your calories, you don't feel any more full, so then you eat the same amount of food. So in a can of pop, there's about 10 teaspoons of sugar, but you're still going to go and you're going to eat just as much.
You just freaked out a whole bunch of parents over the juice
yeah,
thing, you know that.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Yeah.
And patients always come in and they say, well, I don't give my kids a lot of juice. It's like diluted, like 10% of juice to 90% of water. And maybe that's okay, but the thing is they're learning that they're drinking juice, and so they're not going to choose milk and they're not going to choose water. They want to go for the sweet stuff. So if you just start out right at the beginning and you just never introduce them to juice and you give them lots of fruit, then that's kind of what they learn to expect. But it's never too late. You can always change if you're worried. So the second food trap are things that, again, the things that we think are healthy. So these were supposed to not show in the first place, but the first one's supposed to be like a wild blueberry muffin from your favorite coffee shop. The middle one is a honey dip donut, and the last one is a plain bagel. So the muffin tops out in calories, 340 calories, but look at the fat. So the muffin has like double the fat of the honey dip donut, and we think, I would never eat a donut. I'm eating the muffin. I think I'm being healthy. But
I'm eating a donut after today.
So the thing is this, though. That's a honey dip donut. If you get into the cakey donuts and the donuts that have things on top and things inside, then you can surpass the muffin. But you do have to be careful about what you eat. So that's another thing. So what about thinking, well, I'm going to have that wild blueberry muffin, but it's okay because I'm going to work it off later because I'm going to go for a walk. So on the next slide, to burn off that 340 calories from that wild blueberry muffin, it'll take 45 minutes of swimming, 90 minutes of weight training, or 100 minutes of walking. So that's over and above what you should normally be doing for your exercise. So if you're trying to be cautious with your calories, say goodbye to the muffin, because like, who has time to do this kind of exercise?
I need a coach.
Now, there's another website and an app called MyFitnessPal.com. So if you're trying to be cautious about calories or you're trying to lose some weight, you can actually put in some stats about yourself, tell the computer how much weight you want to lose, and then they have a thing where you can put in the calories. It actually will scan barcodes of some pretty popular things, and it will tell you how many calories you're having, and then you input what you're doing for exercise, and it'll make a little balance for you. So you know you have this many more calories, maybe you can have that honey dip donut, or you better get out and you better start walking now because you're negative in the exercise part of things. So that might be helpful for people. All right, then we talked about we wonder about the bad foods, and of course fat is something that always comes up. So not all fats are bad for you. Most fats, honestly, probably are. But there are some fats that are good, and they're called the HDL fats. And you can get them in things like avocados or walnuts or almonds. So those are good fats. They're good for your body and actually good for your heart. You do have to be a little careful, though, because things that have those fats still have calories. So nuts are pretty high calories. So you can't just go and start eating handfuls and handfuls and handfuls of nuts if you're trying to keep your calories down. But it'll be a better choice to have a little handful of walnuts than to, say, have a handful of cashews, which don't have the good fats. What about no-fat products? Because they've got all kinds of those things on the market now. Well, they've looked at people who buy no-fat products, and actually they find that oftentimes you eat more of it because you think it's okay because it's no fat. And the other thing is that if there's no fat in it, when you take away fat, you take away flavor. So they have to put something else in to make it palatable enough that we're actually going to eat the thing. So there may be more sugar in it or more other things that aren't really good for our bodies.
That's what I find with the gluten-free stuff. A lot of times it's packed more with sugar and salt than normal, yeah.
So sometimes it's actually better to buy full-fat product, but just have a little bit of it, because fat actually also helps you feel satisfied. So that might keep you full longer. And if you eat something that's no fat, you're like, well, I just ate a whole bunch of nothing, because kind of you did. And then you might want to eat something again in like another half an hour. So fat is not bad. So, of course, when I'm talking to with my patients about these things, they're saying, well, you just don't want me to do anything that's fun or good. And that's not true. When we're talking about living more healthy, we really want it to be a life thing. So not something that you do for a month or for 3 months or 6 months for a year, but hopefully you change so that you do this the rest of your life. So don't forget to give yourself breaks. If it's your birthday, you go out and you go crazy with whatever it is that you want to do. Maybe once a week within reason. And then, you know, once a week or once a month, maybe you give yourself a treat day. So honestly, you know, John talked a lot last week about pop and chips, and chips are like my thing. If there's a bad thing that I want to eat, it's potato chips. So once a week, maybe you let yourself have like a little bag of potato chips, but not the big, huge Costco. I mean, you know, that store brand of potato.
We're back to Costco. I know. Boulder chips are the best chips, the healthier chips.
What kind of chips?
Yeah, Boulder. They're called Boulder. Yeah, okay. Real Canadian sells them. I think, I can't remember who else, but the Boulder, and they've got them on sale right now, two bags for $5, for $4, I mean, two for $4. They are the best tasting chip, and they're the healthiest chip on the market.
So. Healthiest chip on the market, but that's comparing chips, remember?
And
they get us to buy more things by saying, well, it's two for $4, so it's cheaper, so why don't you buy more? So that's not really like what we're
No, sorry about that. Okay.
I'm just saying.
I'll be better second service, I promise. I'll be much better second service. I just want to speak, you know, Darlene and I, in our family, we dramatically changed our eating habit year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, and the first thought of me, in fact, I went into the supermarket and I walked up in the aisles and I got at the aisles and some of my favorite foods and I said, bye, I'm never going to see you again, farewell, and people thought I was crazy because I started waving at all this food product that I was never going to see again, but I can tell you honestly that now I am very happy and I would never go back to the way we used to eat before. I know a lot of people say, can you ever eat anything that tastes good? Yeah, you can.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Anyway, how much time we got? 5, maybe 7 minutes?
Oh, my word. Okay.
Okay.
We got to get going.
Yeah.
So when you're at the grocery store, if you stay on the outside, if you just go around the perimeter, you'll hit all the good things that you're supposed to have. And if you avoid all those inside aisles, you'll probably miss all the things that you really shouldn't have. Okay, wow, 7 minutes. Here we go. Okay, so how we eat. So where do you eat? So think about the last week. Where did you eat dinner? Where did you eat lunch? Were you sitting at the table with your family having great conversation or with friends? Were you sitting at a desk while you're working? Were you eating in the car as you're taking the kids to something? Were you sitting in you're in front of the TV and you're just watching TV? So again, our thought life comes back into it, because if you're sitting in front of the TV, you're just kind of shoveling food into your mouth. You're not really tasting it and you're not really thinking about it and you don't really know how much you're eating. So we sort of have to think we should be probably sitting around the table with each other. How much do we eat? So we don't really have a good idea of serving sizes anymore. So the Canada Food Guide, it's not a perfect guide by any means, but it will tell you what is a serving size. So sometimes it's good to actually go back and measure out things for a while so you sort of get to know what you're doing. Can you really eat just one? Do you remember that potato chip commercial? So they actually looked at people eating desserts. So they say if you have one bite of cheesecake, you'll actually be as satisfied as if you eat the whole piece of cheesecake. Difficult to do, but you know, try it sometime, because you have that first bite and you have that flavor.
They didn't study me. I wasn't part of that.
You get the flavor and the mouthfeel of it, and then as you keep eating it, you kind of don't have that same appreciation. I only know that because maybe sometime in my life I've eaten too many potato chips. So, and then how fast do we eat? So we tend to eat fast because we're always in a hurry, or we eat really fast and it's something that we really, really like, so we go back and we have a second serving. So what you need to remember is it takes about 20 minutes for the signal to get from your stomach to your brain that you've eaten something. So if you eat more slowly and you're having conversation, you're going to feel full at the end of the meal. If you eat in 5 minutes, maybe you're going to eat twice as much as you really need to eat.
It takes 20 minutes for the signal? That explains a lot. Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Okay, so when do we eat? So we eat like when we're sad, and we eat when we're happy to celebrate, and we eat when we're upset, and we eat when we're stressed. So what we're looking for is comfort, and a lot of times food gives us comfort. So the idea is not that we don't want people to have comfort, but you know, when Fern was here, she talked about shifting our emotions. So she taught us a technique to say, hey, we're going to take these emotions that are not as healthy, we're going to move them, we're going to bring in positive emotions, and we're going to hold on to those emotions. So we can still get comfort, but from doing different things. We're going to skip to food as medicine. So John talked to food as medicine. So this guy, Dr. David Katz, he's an internal medicine specialist at Yale, and he does research. So in 2014, he looked at all the diets that were out there. So the low fat, the low carb, the low glycemic index, the vegan, the paleo diet, all these diets, to look for medical evidence for and against them. And at the end of the day, the winner in terms of all the diets was real food. So no diet in particular. So, sorry, can you go back for 1 second there? So they said a diet of minimally processed foods, so again, real and fresh foods, close to nature, mostly plants, because we know that we get the bad fats from animal products, is decisively, not maybe, but decisively associated with health promotion and disease prevention. So real foods are the way to go. They just came out with this, or they're coming out with this movie called, and I might mispronounce this, but the POP protocol. POP is a place in Italy. So they looked at the Mediterranean diet, and we know that people who eat the Mediterranean diet, which is like olive oil and seeds and nuts and fruits and things, have lower cardiovascular disease. And we've thought it's because of the, we've thought that it's been because of the diet for a long time. But when they actually studied it, they found it wasn't just the diet alone. They looked at how people ate, and they ate in community. They ate with friends and family, and they took their time, and they talked over it. They didn't go to the gym, but they did activity. So they went and they biked together, and they hiked together, and they took breaks in life. They took the siestas, and they, you know, for us, they took the Sabbaths, and they rested. And that whole thing was really why their cardiovascular risk went down. And in fact, by changing some of these things, and specifically the diet, they showed that the cardiovascular risk can go down in weeks. So not months or years, but weeks. So you can really make a difference even if you already have heart disease or if you're trying to prevent heart disease really quickly.
So that's a promo for our Sunday dinners for people to gather together because it's actually healthy for them.
Exactly, if you bring the right kinds of foods.
If you bring the right kinds. No poppin' chips.
Yeah, right, okay. No poppin' chips or the boulder chips.
This reminds me of saying, I can't remember where I got it, but you are what you eat has already eaten.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's already always has. Did I say it right, hon? Or did I say it wrong?
It's close enough.
It's close. I got it from you. Okay. Right. You are what you eat has already ate or something. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So let's talk about the E word for a really short time. So the E word, exercise, right? So exercise doesn't have to be a bad word. That's what I want you to come out of this from. Because exercise can be a really good thing for us. So they looked at a study of fatness versus fitness. Sounds mean to say fatness, but fatness versus fitness. So in 2014, they took a number of people that were normal weight, but they were fit, and they compared them to unfit people of various weights, so people who were overweight and underweight and normal weight. So the unfit people, regardless of their BMI, which is body mass index, tells us what our weight should be compared to our height, had twice the risk of all-cause mortality, death from any cause, compared to fit people. So if you took a fit person who was overweight, you were still more healthy than an unfit person who was at the perfect body weight. So some people really have a hard time getting their weight down, and there's this thing called set point, that we all have a set point where our weight sort of is going to be at, and it's hard to move it from there. So don't lose hope. If you get fit, you're still going to really improve your physical health.
That's a big takeaway. That's a huge takeaway.
Okay, we're going to skip the next slide and go to why else is exercise good? Because exercise can reduce your risk of cancer. So some of these numbers are huge. You can lower your risk of colon cancer 30 to 40%, breast cancer 20 to 80%, uterine cancer 20 to 40%, lung cancer 20%, and you can slow the disease progression in prostate cancer. So cancer is one of those things that are... as a physician, it's disheartening because cancer, there's so much of it. We put so much money into it, and it just seems like we don't really make a lot of progress. So hopefully this encourages you to say, if I get fit and if I exercise, I can lower my risk of cancer. Now, please don't hear me to say, if you've had cancer, if somebody that you know has had cancer, it's not like you caused it because you didn't exercise. That's just not the case at all. But here's the good news. Maybe there's something that we can do to decrease our risk of cancer.
All right. We've got to jump to the last.
Okay.
Can we do the summary?
Yeah,
if that's okay, because we've come. Wow.
My canceriq.ca. I'm jumping to the summary right after this. But it's a website put out by Cancer Care Ontario. You can go on there, put in some information about yourself. And for some of those big cancers that we've seen, it'll tell you, is your risk lower? Is your risk average? Is your risk higher? And then it'll tell you why. So there may be some things that you can change about your lifestyle that'll decrease your risk for those cancers. Okay, so jumping to the end, which is the Start Something Now slide. So, I mean, as a Christian, we know, John talked about last week why it's important to take care of our physical health. I mean, God created us, and Jesus dwells in us, and that is amazing, and that is intimidating. And there's also a real weight bias out in society. So as a physician, like, I think about that. If I'm going to tell my patients they need to do these things, and I certainly need to do them, or they're not going to listen to me because I don't have any validity. And it's the same thing as Christians. People, unfortunately, if you are unfit and if you are overweight, they tend to listen to you less. So, I mean, just as a real point of practicality, we're supposed to get the gospel out there. So here's the challenge for us as a church, because we want to thrive. So I want us to choose one thing to improve about your physical health in the month of November. So pray about it. What is it going to be for you? Maybe it has nothing to do with eating or exercise. Maybe it has something to do with your thought life or your emotional life, but choose something and then tell somebody about it. So be accountable to people and then pray some more about it, because really the way that we can make these changes is through the strength of God and really through God alone.
So you're asking everybody to, you're giving them a challenge for the month of November.
Right.
To do one thing.
Yes.
Mine's Costco. I'm not. No more. Give us. I actually borrow other people's cards. Okay.
You're gonna have to bleep that out too. So make it a smart goal for yourself, and you've heard of the smart thing before. So make it specific. So patients who come in and they say, well, I'm just going to live more healthy. I say, yeah, that's not going to do it, because if you say that, you're not going to do anything, right? So you have to be really specific about what it's going to be. Make it measurable. So at the end of November, you can look back and say, like, did I do this or didn't I do this? Make it realistic. So if you've never gotten off the couch to walk or run and you expect yourself to do a 10K at the end of November, then I'm going to be resuscitating you, so please don't do that. Maybe you say, hey, I want to walk for 10 minutes or I want to jog for 10 minutes. That's fantastic. If you do anything to improve your physical health, that's great. Make it time limited, only that if you say I'm going to do this for the next year, it is a very daunting task. If you say I'm going to do it for a month, then you can probably do that. And then at the end of that month, then you choose another goal and you set that for a month, or maybe you set that for 3 months, and all of a sudden your lifestyle has changed and you feel better, like John and Darlene and the changes that they've made, and you don't want to go back. So the biggest thing is that small incremental changes, you don't have to change everything, and please don't try and change everything. Make a little change and then make another little change, and all of a sudden you're living more healthy.
Yeah, we have a saying in our house that, small hinges swing big doors.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because this can seem very daunting to a lot of us, but we need to start somewhere. We need to start somewhere.
And the last thing is, you know, we've talked a lot about cutting down food and eating less food and exercising more, but for some people, you know, exercise is a really unhealthy thing, and that's the way that they get their comfort for unhealthy reasons, or food can be a really painful thing. And this is not to ignore that, and if you're one of those people that food is not an issue of eating too much, it may be an issue of eating too little, or maybe not eating at all, or maybe you exercise too much, and that's unhealthy for you, that's really, really important as well. And so, you know, see your doctor or go to public health or see a counselor who can help you with that as well.
Wow. How do we honor God with our bodies, right? Is our body a temple, a temporary shell, or an amusement park? And thank you, Dr. Jill, for challenging us today, and hope you take seriously the challenge for November, that we can, as a congregation, do better and get better together for the sake of the gospel, the sake of Jesus Christ. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up as Dr. Jill gets back to her seat. And thank you very much. Yeah. And let me pray. Father in heaven, thank you for the challenge this morning, and to be reminded of these things that are part of our lives each and every day, and yet we can take it for granted. And yet how many of us are probably hurting ourselves or making it more difficult, or allowing ourselves not to thrive to the degree that you want us to. Lord, may this morning be a challenge for someone here to be able to change their lives, to surrender themselves to you and to honor their bodies in a way that allows them to live healthier, more productive lives, so they can be a better representative of you and what it means when we surrender ourselves wholly to you. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.